Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
This week we saw the Melbourne Institute release its latest information, the latest version of the Household Income and Labour Dynamics in Australia report, known as HILDA, of course, a beautiful acronym. Now, HILDA has a really interesting history, and it's a really interesting survey. Unlike the census or unemployment stats that regularly come out and give a kind of snapshot, this one is a long-term study of the same households. Starting in 2001, it's been tracking the same nationally representative group of Australians during the course of their lives. Melbourne Institute Deputy Director and report co-author Professor Roger Wilkins joins us. Welcome to Open House.
Thank you.
Firstly, HILDA itself. How does HILDA give us a different picture than we might find in, say, the annual census or the regular ABS statistics on jobs growth and the economy?
Yeah, what distinguishes HILDA is that we're longitudinal. So we're interviewing the same people every year. So we started in 2001 with a random sample from right across Australia, and then we've been going back every year to the same people. So we're building up a moving picture, if you like. It's like a movie of people's lives as opposed to the photographs that you get from the ABS data.
Albeit a time-lapse movie. How interesting that is. How many people in your study?
We've got about 17,500 people aged 15 and over. Wow. That we interview each year. We also have about 4,000 children under 15 who will hopefully eventually, when they hit 15, will also join the sample.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, I'm just going to take it as read that your original sample was random and truly representative and all of those kind of things. So let's skip ahead to this. As a group of people, how are they faring?
The overwhelming impression is that Australian society works pretty well, that on the whole, people are able to live the life they aspire to. Well, I want to sort of quickly follow that up with the statement that the data also show that there are many people who are having a difficult time of it, who are not achieving what they a life that they would aspire to, and there are certainly many problems. I think we tend to sometimes focus a bit too much on that in the sense that we think everyone's struggling when that's clearly not the picture we get.
Well, look, exactly what I was just thinking, and the point of the question was really to kind of say, well, it's really important that, and particularly from our perspective, we're a program about faith and life and hope, particularly to focus on those people who need extra assistance and who need our support.
Yeah.
But by and large, if Australia can't look at a group of representative Australians and say, we're doing pretty well, then there's almost no country on the earth at the moment that can.
That's right, yes.
Now, so from that point of view, you do see that the global financial crisis had an impact on jobs in this country. Now, we were supposed to see the emergence of a new type of economy. Are we seeing that?
Certainly the HILDA data do show a sort of a tale of two periods. The period leading up to the GFC when incomes were growing extraordinarily strongly, unemployment was declining, and all sorts of other measures of the household economic well-being were improving. And since then, we've kind of treaded water. So we haven't gone backwards, but we haven't really progressed. So household incomes in real terms have stayed pretty stable, not increasing or decreasing. Employment rates are fairly stable. Number of people on welfare benefits is really relatively stable. The labour market has certainly continued to evolve and change, but that's a constant. That's been a feature of modern economies throughout their history. The nature of jobs that we do has changed. So there's always job destruction going on, but it's accompanied by job creation. And so, we're increasingly doing service jobs. There is a bit of a perception that there's been growth in casualisation of the workforce and growth in the gig economy, these app-enabled jobs like Uber and Deliveroo and the like. But in fact, the rate of casual employment in the economy hasn't changed in the last 30 or 25 years. There hasn't really been any growth in casual employment as a share of all employment. And there's not a lot of evidence for growth in the gig economy, or at least the extent that it is growing. It seems to be mostly substituting for already existing self-employment. So we're seeing Uber drivers replacing traditional taxi drivers who were typically self-employed.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. Now, of course, economic growth driven by jobs growth or the growth in the value of underlying assets like housing, all of that's very important to our ongoing economy. And, of course, the Reserve Bank is well known for being concerned now about this cycle that we're in of low interest rates and low jobs growth. Do you see any reason in the Hilda longitudinal survey for us to be either concerned or optimistic about what seems to be a pretty static sort of environment?
So one of the things that we're seeing is that while unemployment hasn't risen, underemployment has. We have got more people in part-time jobs who would like to be working more hours and can't find as many hours as they want. So I think there is a softness in the economy that is not showing up through the traditional metrics like the unemployment rate that is a cause for concern. And I think also, you know, we would like to be seeing improvement in wages and household incomes. There is that sense that well, in fact, we have seen some pickup in productivity growth, but it, for some reason, hasn't as yet translated into wages. Is there cause for alarm? No, I think there's always alarmists around saying that the world as we know it is about to end, that machines will be taking all our jobs. and I think those sorts of views aren't supported by history or the data. There are perhaps existential threats, but I don't think they're to do with technology and global trade. I think it's possibly more to do with the natural environment where those sorts of concerns should be focused.
That's really interesting. Our guest on Open House is one of the authors of the Hilda report, this special longitudinal long-term study of households, Dr. Roger Wilkins from the Melbourne Institute. He's the deputy director there. All right, well, so there are indeed reasons for us to be concerned about groups in society that are disengaged. And interestingly, those, you've got some good data on who's most likely to be in financial stress.
Yes. By financial stress, what we're talking about here is various experiences that happen because of a shortage of money. So it's inability to pay the rent or mortgage, or having to go to a welfare agency of some kind for help, or skipping meals, or not heating the home because of a lack of money. These sorts of things are called indicators of financial stress. And what we see there is that rates of financial stress are particularly high for single-parent families. Single-parent families also show up on other measures. And what's interesting, I think, there is that elderly people often show up with relatively high rates of poverty, but they actually have quite low rates of financial stress. One of the reasons for that is that the traditional poverty measures typically don't take account of housing costs. So many of the elderly own their own home. Also learnt, I guess, perhaps to live within their means. They obviously have a lot of health expenses, but then we've also got a healthcare system that's doing a reasonable job of meeting those health expenses for many of the elderly. So we do see lower rates of financial stress amongst the elderly, even though they have relatively high rates of income poverty.
Indeed. Back to the idea that it's tough being a single parent. You're living in a single parent family as well. More likely to depend on welfare, more likely to be renting than owning their own home. So this is real.
That's right. Yeah, I don't think anyone would choose to be a single parent as their first preference. I think most people would rather be in a well-functioning sort of couple family, but of course for various reasons people find themselves in this situation, and it is a very difficult one, because while we would like single parents to be participating in employment as much as possible, they often face very difficult decisions because of the childcare costs that might entail, apart from anything else.
And you found that those childcare costs are going up.
Yes.
No surprise there, I suppose.
No, particularly for those who are using childcare. So we are seeing more people than ever using childcare, particularly to allow them to work. But that's one contributor to the rising share of household budgets that's going on childcare costs, but by far the bigger factor is that the price, you know, per day or per hour of care has more than doubled in real terms since around 2002. So that's a that's a big big increase.
Now, Professor Wilkins, you've had some interesting findings when you collate all of the data about gender differences. So women still underpaid compared to their male counterparts, matter of fact, underemployed as well. Returning to the workforce after childbearing means that most women in your study don't catch up.
No, that's right. Attitudes have changed a lot. Both men and women are much more receptive to the idea that men take a more active role in raising the kids and doing the housework and women taking more of a role in employment. But, well, the receptiveness to that idea hasn't changed behaviour a great deal, so particularly when the first child arrives. We see a big divergence open up between men and women in the roles they take. It makes sense just from an economic perspective. It makes sense to sort of specialise at that point in time. But I think it is contributing to some, I guess, adverse consequences for women. We were referring to single parents before. We do know that about a third of marriages will break down. And so women are sort of, in the longer term, in a lot more financially vulnerable position if they have withdrawn from the labour market and put their careers on hold. In the event of relationship breakdown, their earnings potential is a lot lower, and also their superannuation contributions will be lower subsequently, so they would have a lower living standard in retirement. And we certainly do see that. We mentioned before, single parents have high rates of poverty, but also elderly single women have higher rates of poverty and disadvantage more generally than even single elderly men. So there is a sort of a from a long-term perspective, a reason for us to be interested in having a more equitable distribution of paid and unpaid work within the household for that reason, even though families might be quite happy with that arrangement at the time.
Professor Roger Wilkins is with us, the Deputy Director of the Melbourne Institute and the co-author of the Hilda Report, based at the University of Melbourne. How do you imagine that this research, as you continue it, will be used? Is it your hope that it impacts on social policy?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think, that's what we see as its value to the taxpayer who does ultimately fund this study. Very much the hope is that that the study would impact on policy. I think at a most basic level, our hope is that it means we have correctly informed policy. So when the community and policymakers more specifically are forming judgments about what needs to be done and what should be done, it's very important that that's based on an understanding of the true state of affairs. And so this is where objective data collected from Australians throughout the country is really important. We're very prone to misperceptions based on our own anecdotal observation, and I think and that can lead to, I think, bad policy outcomes. So that's at a very base, at a very basic level. And obviously, there are many sort of specific ways in which we'd be hoping it would inform policy. For example, that we're identifying those in the community who are persistently in poverty. Rather, they're probably more of a priority for policy than people who temporarily get into difficulty but then manage to get themselves out of it.
So emergency relief is obviously critically important, short-term help critically important, but, in fact, we're having this discussion on the program only a few weeks ago, looking at long-term trends for, say, housing stress means we need to find long-term solutions rather than only the short-term handout,
right,
which sometimes can actually sustain people in poverty.
Exactly. That's right. That you can end up perpetuating the circumstance rather than alleviating it. That's right. Yeah.
Now, look, just finally, these studies are brilliant for all of the things that they uncover, and there's just one outlying piece of data here that I thought was really interesting to highlight, because a lot of people complain about what happens on the roads. Turns out an increasing number of younger people are losing their licences.
Well, or not getting them in the first place. We've only observed twice whether people have a licence in 2012 and 2016. And there we saw amongst younger people around about 2% reported having a licence in 2012 and not having a licence in 2016. So it looks like that was the group who, probably for traffic violations, who lost their licence. But I think the bigger shift was that we're seeing fewer and fewer people in the, particularly the 18 to 24 range, reporting that they have a licence. So there were fewer 18 to 24-year-olds who had a licence in 2016 than 18 to 24-year-olds in 2012 that had a licence. So it seems like eventually most people get the licence, about 95% of people eventually get a driver's license, but they seem to be getting it later. You know why that is? I think one reason might be that it's sort of probably become a bit more difficult to get a license.
It has 120 hours in some states.
Yeah, that's right. That's costly. Yes. You know, particularly if you haven't got a parent willing to help out.
That's exactly the finding that politicians ought to have a look at and say, "Well, was that a bit of a perverse outcome, or was it a good thing? Yep. Do we actually intend for that to happen?"
You know, I guess the people responsible for this policy are very focused on probably one outcome, which is road safety, road deaths.
Yes.
And that's obviously very important, but it's not the only consideration, obviously, because if we wanted to eliminate all road deaths, we could simply ban driving. Mm. And no one would think that that was an improvement, because obviously being able to drive allows you to do things like get to work and get to the shops and get the kids to school and all sorts of other things. And so, you know, at the margin, if we're making it tougher for young people to get a license, it could be having unintended consequences in terms of their ability to further their education or get to work and, you know, get employment. And, you know, we certainly see a very strong association between unemployment and license holding. So the unemployed have much lower rates of license holding than the employed. It's not
trivial
point to make. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, good. Well, that's the value of this type of research. And imagine being the person that has their head around it all, and that's you. So thank you for what you do, and thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Professor Roger Wilkins, he's with the Melbourne Institute and Melbourne University, and they published the HILDA survey. It's available for you online to take a look at. You could Google HILDA, and it'll take you to the melbourneinstitute.unimelb.edu.au site. There it is, I've said it. And you can find out more about that, including that last part. I wonder whether that's the outcome that our community accepts, that by changing how difficult it is, for good and proper reasons to do with road safety, by changing how difficult it is to get a licence, the statistics are now starting to show that fewer and fewer young people are getting their licences until they're older, 25. As I say, a good thing for some, for others who might need that for work reasons, quite difficult.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.